Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and this episode is Q&A number 87. Before we get into today's questions, big thanks to our sponsors. First, we have Precision Hydration, and today I want to take a moment to mention some content that they have been producing on their YouTube channel, which are so-called on-Nomi conversations, interviews that founder Andy has done with various athletes and coaches and people in the endurance sports industry in general. And I personally recently did one with a conversation with Andy where we talked about things like training through the pandemic. We talked about working from home. We talked about building run volume and running load gradually. And we talked about favorite books and audiobooks and things related to and not related to training. So it's a 20 to 30 minute long chat that you can have a look at on Precision Hydration's YouTube channel. And of course, if you are in need of electrolyte products, Precision Hydration make electrolyte products that match how you sweat. And you can get 15% off your order with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW15 on precisionhydration.com. And big thanks to Roka. And we have some really, really big news from Roka today, which is that they have launched their new and updated flagship wetsuit model. The Maverick X2 is here. So this wetsuit has been redesigned. It has a redesigned core that basically makes it stiffer if we compare it to a bike, for example. You know how a bike which has good stiffness allows you to really produce a lot of power from the pedals into the ground and less waste of energy simply. And that is what Roka has done with the Maverick X2 while still retaining full mobility. But that transfer of power produced to speed in the water has improved. They have also added even more buoyancy to the Maverick X2. One of the things that I was amazed at when I got into the Maverick X the first time was how amazing the buoyancy was, but apparently now it is even better. And they have an entirely new taping technique that connects the shoulders to the hips with the propulsion of power from hips to shoulders being much, much improved and giving you even more propulsion to the water, translating into better speed. So that and a lots of other new innovations in design based on materials and engineering, really amazing stuff. Go and read about it on roka.com. And you can get 20% off your order with the promo code roka.com/TTS. Now to today's questions, which are from Love in Sweden, who writes, "Hi Michael, what are your thoughts on training zones when it comes to pool swimming or even outdoor swimming? I try to keep track of time in zone distribution of all my training, but I find swimming to be the hardest. In the pool, I prefer not to swim with a chest strap, which probably won't help much anyway, as swimming won't raise heart rate much and it probably won't have time to stabilize my heart rate. Speed zones is one way, but speed changes dramatically when I'm using a pool buoy or paddles or fins, and this for me is the biggest problem. Do you have any input on how you handle this for yourself and your athletes? It would be much appreciated. Thank you for the great podcast." All right, thank you, Love, for your question. My simple one sentence summary is that I do not consider it worthwhile trying to track time in zone in swimming. I do that neither for indoor nor outdoor swimming for myself nor my athletes. And if we go into some more details as for why, there are several reasons, and the primary reason is you're alluding to it already, but just good data collection is difficult or impossible. First, a lot of athletes don't actually like swimming with a GPS watch, which for me is perfectly fine as a coach, because if the pool has a pace clock, which most pools do, then you don't really need to have a wristwatch. Especially if you are swimming in a group as well, it's unlikely that you will want to lose an extra fraction of a second that could be used to get right up somebody's feet. And you don't want to lose that to start your watch and fiddle with it, and you don't want to be in the way with somebody, even though I know that you can make it really smooth when it comes to turning your watch on and off. But anyway, I think that group swimming generally lends itself perfectly to not swimming with a watch. This is not to poo-poo using watches at all. As a coach, I do like to see the data from watches from those of my athletes that are using watches. But I am also absolutely fine with athletes that don't want to do that and they just comment on how the main set went. So they simply remember roughly the time ranges that they did the main set at and they comment on that. And that is absolutely fine. So if I, as a coach, were to rely heavily on tracking something like the training intensity distribution or time in zone, then I would be really putting myself in a disadvantageous position because I don't have that data from some of my athletes. And the same really goes for any self-coached athlete in terms of if you rely on some data that you cannot accurately track, then you're actually doing yourself a disservice. So you should only track something if you can be sure that it's not garbage in, because garbage in, garbage out applies as always. So, yes, that is something that if you are going to track it, you need to make absolutely sure that you have good data collection. And that's not easy. And sometimes the best solution is simply not to track something because you can't guarantee the integrity of the data. The second reason that I'm not really interested in tracking time in zone for swimming is that even for those that do use wristwatches and get their pace data, the time in zone data that we get from those watches is generally not accurate enough. So I don't trust the training intensity distributions that we get from those wristwatches. You mentioned that one reason for this is the use of tools like fins, pull buoys, paddles, and so on. And that, I agree, is the biggest factor. It will totally mess up your data. But even in a hypothetical scenario where we never use any tools, I would still not trust the accuracy of today's standard wristwatches, the Garmin's and Polar's and the like, when it comes to tracking training intensity distribution and time in zone. And I'm not saying that to be critical of those watches. I think they are doing a great job. They do, of course, measure time correctly for each interval. And I find that for any athlete that can do a decent flip turn, they also measure distance correctly almost 100% of the time, which means that average pace for an interval will be absolutely correct. Where problems arise is when you are swimming at a variable pace. So let's say you do a 500 meter interval where you are alternating between 50 meters fast and 50 meters easy. That is the kind of interval where even though you will be getting the average pace for the 500 spot on from your watch because it knows the distance, it knows the time from start to finish, I would expect the pace distribution chart to be hit and miss, to be honest, based on everything I've seen. And I think this is just my guess for why this might be the reason, but I think it's just difficult for the watch to get the timing right of when one lap starts and the other one ends, so to say. So when is the exact point that you're doing your flip turn? And the thing is that if you're swimming in a 25 meter pool, it's this becomes even more difficult because that means that if it gets the timing off by 1 second, which it might easily do because a flip turn takes you, I guess, 1 second or more, then that means that the pace of that particular lap might be 4 seconds per 100 meters slower or faster than what it actually was, which if you're swimming up to 1 minute 20 seconds per 100 meter pace or slower, at 1 minute 20 seconds per 100 meters, there would be a 5% discrepancy if you are 4 seconds per 100 meters off, which is a lot. Like that's not nothing to be snuffed at. That's swimming, that's measuring threshold pace instead of VO2 max pace or the other way around, essentially. And of course, if you're swimming slower, the percentage error will be slightly different. But I still think that even if it's 4% or 3%, it's quite a lot. And I wouldn't really want to rely on that data. And even worse, to make matters worse, if it mistimed that one lap, then that error might propagate into the next lap because it not only did get the end of the first lap incorrect, but that means that it also gets the start of the second lap incorrect, and so on and so forth. So that error propagation might lead to just basically random data, or at least very much hit and miss data. And I do believe, I should say, that this will probably change within the coming couple of years with new technology being developed. that potentially can measure instantaneous pace with accelerometers in a way that most wristwatches currently aren't really doing. But I don't know if we're there yet, as I haven't tried any of these devices that are working on this. So, I mean, there are devices out there already that are doing this. There's a Canadian company that I'm blanking on the name of, but I'm sure you can Google it. And there's also the Form goggles that I believe are measuring accurate instantaneous data in the pool. Again, not very familiar with too familiar with any of these devices, as I haven't tried them. But if you are really interested and want something that might increase your data accuracy, then you might be interested in having a look at one of these products, for example. Now, regarding heart rate, which, as you say, could be an option for measuring time in zone, I actually think that this is, at this point, the best way to track your training intensity distribution when it comes to swimming. Yes, it is a bit crude. Things like 25-meter sprints will not necessarily be picked up. Heart rate will, of course, increase, but it might increase to zone 4 rather than zone 5 or so and so on, so you won't see just how intense those efforts are. But that is a similar problem that exists in many other sports, like cross-country skiing, and it's what cycling used to be before power meters. It's what running used to be before GPS watches. So no, it's not perfect, but definitely could be useful. It's not useless either. And personally, actually, in the last month or so before the pandemic started, I just got myself a Polar OH1 optical heart rate monitor that I can attach to my goggle strap, and it measures heart rate optically from the temple. And then after the workout, I can sync that heart rate data to Training Peaks, and I assume that most other platforms would work with it as well. And that has been fascinating, and I do think that heart rate in swimming is something that will become a bigger and more important part of monitoring training and assessing training in the not too distant future. I'm definitely interested in that and working on improving my understanding of it, even though, of course, in the current climate, that is a project that has stagnated. You raise some potential issues with regard to heart rate, but I would argue against them. So you're saying that that swimming might not raise your heart rate much, but actually it definitely will. It will raise heart rate more than enough, just as much as cycling and running. It's just the fact that the baseline level is much lower and the max heart rate is also lower. So you will have different absolute values, but you will definitely, if you are varying your paces, you are swimming easy swimming and you're doing hard swimming, then you will see big variations from your low heart rates to your high heart rates. So for me personally, to give you an example, I'm looking at a session right now that I did just before the pools closed. And my easy warm-up swimming in this workout led to heart rates in the 95 to 105 beats per minute range. Compared to when I do my cycling warm-up of a similar effort level, might be 110 to 115, and running might be 115 to 120. Then as my main set, I did a 1500 meter hard effort at 7.3 race pace, essentially, or 7.3 effort. And heart rate started, so I had a bit of a rest before that. So my heart rate was at 72 when I started that interval. It climbed all the way up to 160. So it was almost a 90 beats per minute increase. And you never see that in running or cycling, maybe because you don't have the passive recoveries. But even if, let's say, I would have started it right away from my warm-up without a rest, I would have started it from, let's say, 100, that would still have been a 60 beats per minute increase. So definitely of the same range, if not higher than my increase in heart rate when it comes to running and cycling. And the average for that interval was 140 compared to 95 to 100 for the easy swimming for a 21 to 22 minute interval. So that just goes to show that there definitely is a big increase available for you in heart rate. You just start at a lower level compared to running and cycling. I could pick examples of shorter intervals as well. The rate of increase of heart rate is just as quick as what I see in cycling or running. But again, the baseline level is much lower. So of course, this means that you need to assess your swim training zones and your thresholds separately. Now, how to actually do that? That's a different question. I don't have any great or well-researched answer to that question, but just my quick and dirty summary would be either try to pick a pace that you could hold for at least 30 minutes and swim at that pace for at least 20 minutes. And if your heart rate stabilizes, hopefully it does, then that heart rate, where it stabilizes, could be used as your threshold heart rate. Another option would be to simply pick your maximum heart rate from swimming that you have seen in a hard workout or a test. And I think that doing something like a 1,000 meter time trial might be the best way to see your maximum heart rate in a swim. I think that for most athletes, doing something like a 200 or 400 meter time trial won't quite elicit maximum heart rate. Although that's, I don't have the data to prove that, but that would be my gut feeling. And the second objection or concern you raise with heart rate in swimming is that regarding the time it takes to stabilize heart rate. Well, that's not really an issue with heart rate or with heart rate in swimming. It's your heart rate is what it is. It doesn't lie. It's a response to the training that you're doing based on your physiology. And we just have to learn that swimming is a different sport than running and cycling, but also the way that we are training in swimming might make our physiology behave differently than it does in running and cycling. So yes, I do think that a lot of us non-swimmers in particular probably use, relatively speaking, more anaerobic energy in swimming than we do in cycling and running, which means that for intervals of shorter nature, your heart rate won't stabilize as quickly as it might do in cycling and running. But on the other hand, that's not a bad thing. That tells you exactly what you did in that set, and it gives you information about your physiology. So this, I think, already shows you a bit about what I think about heart rate in swimming. I'm not convinced that using it for time in zone tracking is all that relevant, but I am very interested in the information it can give us in terms of looking at the heart rate response to particular swim sets. And from that, we can get information about what might be things that we need to work on as swimmers. So that would be my 2 cents on heart rate. But again, I do think that if you choose to track time in zone, then heart rate is probably going to be the most accurate, definitely compared to pace from standard wristwatches. Just be aware that your swimming heart rate training intensity distribution is not and should not be the same as your bike and run training intensity distribution for heart rate. You need to treat it on its own merits, which basically you have to be a trailblazer a bit because there isn't a lot of information out about that. I have personally barely scratched the surface of it. I hope that this time next year I might be able to talk much more about my experience with it. But for now, anybody who gets into that needs to experiment, and it's not necessarily going to pay off because that sort of stuff really takes some time to figure out. But moving on from heart rate, going back to the third reason why I don't see the value in tracking time in zone, this relates directly to what I said above, that in swimming, we don't really have much data or benchmarks for what time in zone, quote-unquote, should be, compared to cycling and running, at least, where there is a lot more data and a lot more research. And I think it would be a mistake to assume that the principles just carry over directly from those sports to swimming. Yes, there are principles that apply, but it's not a 100% correlation. So it could make sense to start tracking it now, and with time you learn more and more and you blaze a trail for yourself. I will start doing that, I think, but as a self-coach athlete, if you're spending time on it, I think that that's something that you shouldn't be doing, to be honest. I think that time might be better spent training or doing something else, sleeping, cooking, eating healthy food, those sorts of things, rather than looking at those charts that you're not necessarily going to get any actionable data from. But if you do have a good understanding of physiology, I would use heart rate, as I said, to assess your training response to different sets, because that could be immediately actionable as opposed to training intensity distribution information, just because of the lack of benchmarks and a lot of data on training intensity distribution in swimming. That being said, if you do want to track your time in zone and you don't want to use heart rate, there is another simple way that you could do that, and you could do it accurately, I think, much more accurately than the speed. And I have done that at periods through my coaching, but then I found that it wasn't very actionable. It does require a bit of spreadsheet work, but not much. So let me tell you how this works. Let's say you do a workout that consists of a 1,000 meter easy warm-up. Then you do 5 fast, hard efforts of 100 meters each. Then you do 5 times 300 meters at 70.3 race pace. And then you finish off with 500 meters easy. You could simply measure your distance in zone rather than your time in zone. And this session, you don't even need to do the session. You can just, when you have it written out on paper, on your training plan, even before you have done the session, so in the planning stage, you can already calculate your distance in zone. And assuming that you are going to be following your sessions, then this is going to be very, very accurate. So this particular session would give you 1,500 meters of low intensity training, which would be the 1,000 meter at the start and the 500 at the end. It would give you 1,500 meters of moderate intensity training, which is the 5 times 300 at 7.3 race effort. And it would give you 500 meters of high intensity, which would be the 5 times 100 fast efforts before that 5 times 300 meter set. So really, you don't have to get overly complicated with this sort of system. Keep it simple, keep it consistent for you. There is no absolute right or wrong there, but you need to follow a consistent system for you. And then you can simply see over time, track over time, how much of each of low intensity, moderate intensity, and high intensity training you accumulate. Personally, I might classify your critical swim speed as the lowest intensity that falls in the high intensity bucket, actually, because I think that CSS tends to feel quite a bit more intense and less sustainable than anaerobic threshold, at least the way that I tend to test it and assess it on the bike and the run. But that's just my preference. And again, you don't have to go with that preference. You can go with your own preference as long as you're consistent for yourself. And for what it's worth, quite a lot of the training intensity distribution research that has been done has used similar methodologies to this. It's just basically pouring through training diaries and classifying training according to those diaries in the way that I exemplified above. And as a final takeaway message, the way that I handle this by actually not measuring and tracking time in zone is I mostly look at what athletes have historically been able to handle. And if I am to increase the amount of moderate or hard swimming that the athlete does, I do that gradually from that historical baseline. So for example, if an athlete historically has been swimming on average 4 times per week, of which 2 of those swims have had like a hard main set, and they have been able to sustain this for several weeks, I consider that a baseline that I'm happy to add to if I think that we need to do that to apply a sufficient stimulus for them to improve if they are stagnant, for example. On the other hand, if they are still improving with what they're doing, I wouldn't necessarily change anything. There's no point. But again, if they're stagnant, then I would either look at, and if we have ruled out that they're actually not under-recovered or anything like that, but we need to up the stimulus somehow, the first choice might be to add more volume, of course, if that's possible. But in some cases, it's not possible or not even desirable in some cases. I would then, if it comes to adding intensity to get that additional stimulus, I would be okay with trying to increase the amount of moderate or high-intensity training by 500 meters per week. And for a few weeks, for 3 to 4 weeks, and then hold steady for several weeks and make sure that the athlete can handle that consistently. So this really isn't that different from a time in zone or a distance in zone, to be honest, from a coach's perspective for me, because the fact is that there's never going to be a magical training intensity distribution that applies to everybody. That's a conversation we've had multiple times when it, as it pertains to the 80-20 rule, so to say. And it's always going to be individual what an athlete can and cannot do. So as a coach, I would basically have to keep track of multiple athletes' times in zones and for different disciplines, and what is sustainable individually for each of my athletes. So it is very similar to this approach, which is more based on a simplistic view of their historical training, and just simplifying things enough, but not too much, and applying some basic common sense in gradual increase and progressive overload, and not excessive overload. So that's how I view this, and why I do not think it necessary to use timing zone for swimming, especially since it is, again, so prone to erroneous data that I wouldn't really trust the data anyway at this point in time, unless it's heart rate. So that's basically it for this question. I hope that this helps, and thank you so much for the interesting question. For anybody who has a question, please keep sending them in to michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and it's Michael with a K. A couple of announcements before we go. First, the new beginner Ironman training plan is still on its 60% off launch discount. This is just for a little more than a week by the time that this episode is released. So this offer lasts until the 31st of May. And also another, and go to scientifictriathlon.com for more information and to buy the plan, either as a PDF or on Training Peaks. You can find all the information through our website. Then the other piece of announcement that I have is I'm helping out friend of the podcast and four-peat guest, Dr. Stephen Chung, who is involved in a study in elite and sub-elite athletes. So if you are an elite or a sub-elite athlete, basically how you can help out is just take an internet survey, an online survey. It's a Google form, and this survey is on how COVID-19 is affecting training attitudes and belief in elite and sub-elite athletes. So in the episode description, in your podcast app, you will have a link to that, and you can go and take that, and that would be a massive help. They are hoping to get thousands of athletes involved in that study. I can't remember exactly how many. It might be 10,000. But every single person helps. So definitely go and help science out, because that is how science can... science, it relies on that. Science relies on having subjects to study. Otherwise, there is no science. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and take their free online sweat test and get a personalized hydration strategy for your next race. And you can get 15% off your order of electrolytes with the promo code DETHTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Go and check out the Maverick X2, the new flagship wetsuit, even further improved from the amazing Maverick X. And you can get 20% off that or your order of any combination of wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, and high-performance eyewear with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.